Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Derek Green. Derek Green has spent more than a decade as a professional journalist and a contract consultant for several multinational corporations. His work has taken him to 22 countries on six continents. Green was educated at the University of Michigan, where he was a three-time winner of the prestigious Avery and Jewel Hopwood Award in Creative Writing. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in national magazines and literary journals, and he has taught creative writing and journalism at the university level. He lives in Connecticut with his wife and son and is at work on a novel. He will read tonight from his collection of stories, New World Order, published by Autumn House Press. Hi, Derek. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi, thank you, Ellen.
Could you start off tonight by reading a little bit from New World Order?
Yes, I will. I'm going to start reading the first story.
Great.
So that'll be a natural place for me to begin.
It'll be in order.
All right. That works for me. This is called The Terms of the Deal, and the stories in the book are each set in a different country. And that was one of the sort of challenges I had writing it, was how to make each story in a different place seem, real for readers who probably haven't been to most of the places that the book is set. So this is called The Terms of the Deal. I had been in Baghdad in the green zone for a year and a half when word came down that one of my clients was dead, killed in action. This was always bad news for obvious and not so obvious reasons. No one wanted to see a young man die, but it also meant a deal was blown. A contract had to be reverted. Cash would come out of my pocket. Clarence Brinkman, I read from his file, private first class, all of 23 years old. According to my handwriting, PFC Brinkman had placed an order for a Harley Fat Boy with all the trimmings. Custom skirted back fender, low-riding Badlander seat, polished chrome shotgun exhaust. A sweet machine and expensive on an E2 pay grade. Private Brinkman must have really wanted that bike. I tried to remember who he was. I could sometimes, even months after a deal. But Brinkman from Dayton brought nothing to mind. Just another sad story and one more lost commission. I stamped the file deceased. Military mail would carry it out to Dubai and from there to home office in New York, and that would be the end of that. Or so I thought. A week later, I was sitting with a dog-eared Playboy on my desk when the door to my trailer opened. A soldier strolled in, a big guy in standard ACU fatigues and dusty desert boots. He nodded my way, then clomped around the room, wrists crossed at the small of his back. Not much to see, some posters on the wall, a few glossy product brochures, new cars, trucks, motorcycles, a humble showroom, though not so bad for a combat zone. The man didn't speak at first. Enlisted men could be shy and overly polite around civilians. He wore a pair of hard stripes on his shoulder, two up, a rank you didn't see all that much, a true corporal. Stars and bars was the first thing we learned. Shoulder insignia meant rank, and rank meant pay grade, and pay grade gave you a very good idea of what a prospect could afford to buy. He finished browsing and took a position beside my desk, looking down at the open magazine. "That redhead, one of the products you got on sale here?" he said. "Don't we wish," I responded. "The second thing you learned, move your conversation toward a deal. To be honest," I said, "you look more like a Harley man to me. I'd suggest a soft tail special if you like her." He took the seat across from me. Small blue eyes stared out from his sunburned face. A big guy, like I said, but with the pimply stubble of a kid. When he clasped his hands on the desk in front of me, I saw the thick, scarred knuckles of a combat soldier. "Massey," read the name tape above his right breast. He said, "I've seen guys buy jewelry in the green zone for their girlfriends back home, or a Persian rug, or even get a darn foot massage. Hell, I eat at Burger King about every other day, but I'm going to tell you the truth. I had no idea you all sold cars here, too." "And motorcycles," I said. "Harley Davidson, Buell, American Legends." "American Legends," he said with a smile, "on sale right here. Only the best in the world." I took out a prospecting sheet and penciled his name in the top box. "Mind if I ask how you came to find out about us, Corporal Massey?" "In fact, I don't," he said. buddy of mine bought a motorcycle from you guys a while back on installment plan. Military Advantage Program, I think you call it. He was scheduled to take delivery at his parents' place 122 days from now. Ended up KIA, though. Named Brinkman. I placed the pencil in front of me and laced my own fingers. I remember him, I fibbed. Clarence, PFC. I was real sorry to hear about that, Massey. Yeah, me too, he said. But hey, stuff happens. What could I add to that? Stuff did indeed happen. So, he said, my question is, Brinkman being dead, what happens to that motorcycle? To the motorcycle? I'm not sure I'm following you, Massey. The man leaned forward, elbows to knees, his beady eyes focused on me, and I imagined him on patrol, rifle high, gaze locked, not someone to mess with lightly. It's a pretty simple question, sir. What happens to the bike? It was ordered. It must have been built. His payments were up to date. All that money paid right on time. So, where's the bike? Well, I'm not sure, Massey. I mean, the contract was what we call reverted. That means basically the order was canceled and the money would have to be returned. To a dead guy? Well, no, I said, to the next of kin, I guess. I suppose it would depend on what he had arranged in the case of his, you know. Yeah, Massey said, I know. But the bike itself, I would imagine that goes back to the manufacturer. To be honest, I wasn't sure what happened to the actual machine, and I wasn't all that interested either. What if I told you, Massey said, that I wanted to buy that bike? You mean a bike like that one? Come on, man. I mean that bike. He had an odd, unpleasant grin. I want to buy it myself. Those payments have been canceled, Massey, I said. I'd picked up my pencil and was tapping it on the desk in suspicion. This man's family or the army or someone has that money. You're not hearing me, Massey said. I don't want the money. I want the bike. But the bike's gone. For all I know, it's been sold to someone else or disassembled and put back on the shelves in some factory back home. Well, Massey said, there must be some kind of ID number for it, right? You could at least look that up. Okay, I said. Fair enough. There's a VIN for it, assuming it was ever built. He said, you do me a favor. Look into it for me. If you find that bike, I'll buy it. He climbed to his feet. In fact, what would you say if I told you this? You get that bike for me, I can get 8, 9 other guys come in here and buy ones just like it from you. Yeah, right. I leaned back and clasped my hands behind my head, wondering what I had here, whether joker or thief. Why, I'd say that would be just great, Massey, I said. I'm always looking for new business. I figured you might say that, he said. He passed a card with contract information over my desk. You fill in your little sheet there and get back with me. You let me know what you find out. Deal? Sure, I said. Deal. He gave a curt military nod, plunked a patrol cap on his shaved head, and wandered back out into the heat and the dust.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Derek Green, reading from his collection of stories, New World Order, published by Autumn House Press. So we know from your bio, Derek, that you've lived or at least been around the world more than a few times. And I'm guessing that that's the fodder for a lot of the landscape in your stories. But I was thinking about, like, there are friends of mine that we've talked about that there are certain incidences that happen, kind of world incidents, that then kind of shift your perspective of how you write or what you write. One of the most obvious ones would be 9/11. Like anybody right. who had ever written anything that might have some violence in it or some kind of tension in it, all of a sudden it shifted it and you had to rethink it. And I've been thinking, you know, especially as we're coming out of a extended political campaign, that there's been a lot of talk about kind of Americans and the rest of the world. And I was wondering if you know, somehow as you were writing these stories, something shifted as you were writing them, considering that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And because it did, first of all, very perceptive of you because in the case of this book particularly, it was September the 11th. I started writing the stories that became this book just before that happened. Mm. And I was traveling extensively at the time for business, for work, for, as a journalist, but mostly as a contractor, sort of in the belly of the beast of the sort of American industrial corporate military complex, as you know, as it were, and it was this shattering event, and it changed everything overnight. It changed just how traveling felt and how it felt to be an American abroad, either living abroad if you were an expatriate or traveling a lot back and forth, like my case, and it became a much darker thing. And I was in the middle of writing a book that I thought would have a series of interlinked stories set in different places. And when that happened, everything changed. And I think the book itself became a darker book. The story you just heard is obviously it's set in Iraq, and that that was sort of one of the – I had never intended that. I never planned it. But after everything shifted out from under us, that's sort of the way the book went and the direction it took.
Yeah, when I was reading the stories, I was thinking, you know, I think one of the things that changed then is we as, you know, citizens of the United States, I think felt we had kind of a universal reputation and people responded to us in kind of a universal way. And at that moment, it all kind of fragmented. And I think in the stories, you know, it's very much about different situations in different places. It's not the, oh, here's a default, what a U.S. citizen is like.
I hope, yeah. I think that's true. And the it did change how it felt to be what we thought of ourselves as Americans out in the world changed overnight. And I remember, for instance, I was in Mexico City not long afterward, and there was a discussion, and there was sort of an argument with people I was working with, all of the Mexicans, whether the United States deserved it, whether we had brought it on ourselves. And there was this sort of fragmented thing. And I said to a friend of mine there, a colleague of mine, how different it had been from when Bill Clinton was in office and everything was – it was, you know, everybody was interested in the United States and what was going on. And suddenly there was this sort of debate going on. Had we brought it? So I think there, I saw a lot of – there had always been – you know, there's the ugly American, and there's – you always sense a little latent hostility. And it's so easy – it was so easy being an American abroad. Everybody spoke the language, right, and used the currency. And suddenly there was almost a sense that we were immediately vulnerable, and people were looking at you again with this new light, thinking we didn't think it could happen to you. You know, we didn't.
Yeah.
It was just a complete sea change, and you know, it complicated the book in a way that, in a good way. I mean, you know, that's what writers do, is you write about those things.
And you said, had you written many of the stories?
Well,
before?
No, a handful of them, you know.
I was just wondering if you had to drop any of them, or if you had to completely change any of them, or was it just it gave the whole tone of the book a
shift? Shifted the whole tone of the book, and it made it much more a serious, it linked the stories in a much more serious way, at least in my mind. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a sort of, the way they came about is, it was sort of interesting because I traveled a lot, and I thought I had friends who did it, and they would write travel pieces for slick magazines and these great. And I always intended to do it, and I complained to a friend of mine, you know, what, you're always writing these travel pieces, yet I don't. And he said, well, you know, the difference between you and me is wherever I go, I write an article about it. So, great, thanks for the tip. But it occurred to me that I was a fiction writer, and I'd always, you know, that's why I continued to write fiction, is its own interesting issue.
It wasn't just about the landscape. It was about the stories.
Exactly. And I thought, why not write a short story about the places I've been? And suddenly the book started to come together. And then when this thing happened, this monstrosity occurred, it suddenly, the tone darkened. Exactly like it, because, you know, within a month I was back flying again after September the 11th.
And it probably put a spotlight on the stories in a way that might not have been there before.
Yeah, I think so. It certainly made it, suddenly being abroad had more than just being, you know, the
going
go-go 90s and going out and seeing the world. It suddenly had a whole new meaning to people who didn't travel and who did travel and who did live overseas. Mm-hmm. And so it gave me a structure to the book. The book starts, as you know, it starts after September the 11th, but it ends just before September the 11th. And so it's this fulcrum that operates throughout the book in a weird time scheme. So,
if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and I'm interviewing the writer Derek Green tonight, who's reading from his collection of stories, New World Order. Derek, will you read some more?
Yes. I'm go to another story here. This one's set in South Africa, where I had been. And South Africa's its own interesting situation. I'm going to read from the middle of it. And to sort of understand the book, one of the things, I did a lot of work for the automobile industry, the global, you know, auto, what back when it existed. And when I'd written the book, the title New World Order was sort of meant to be ironic, because there was what we thought the New World Order would be going into the 21st century and what it's become, which nobody, not too many people suspected it would be like. But a car company that I just seemed to be the most old world possible thing. So this is a long way of saying I invented a company, a fictive company for the book that's sort of a Halliburton-esque company. It's like Halliburton if Halliburton really is as bad as all of us fear and thought it would be. And I named it Mason International. And so most of the people either work for it or in some oblique way are touched by it. As one of the characters in the book says, it's this monstrous thing with tentacles that go all over the world. In this story, set in South Africa, one of the characters has been told to fire a local driver. Many of these places, there's locals who work for these huge companies. They would otherwise be impoverished. So there's all kinds of complexities. Is it good to be there? Is it not? Well, it depends, you know. Mm-hmm. So this sort of junior executive has been tasked by his executive to fire one of the locals. And he doesn't think it's just. He's got issues with it. And so that's the setup of the story. And I'm going to read from the middle of it when these people go to meet with some military personnel in an interesting part of South Africa. And they leave from Sandton, which is just an immediate wealthy suburb right outside of Johannesburg. This is called Johnson the Driver, and it's narrated by the unlucky guy who has to fire Johnson the Driver. Pretoria is a relatively short distance from Sandton, but it can seem like a long way. Once you leave the greater Johannesburg area with its sprawl of white suburbs and black shanty towns, the Pretoria Highway slices through scrubland and into the mountains of the Highveld beyond. Broken macadam forms huge tooth-like serrations on the road's edge most of the way, a giant, savage smile. Dotting the landscape here and there are little lean-to villages, lawless and desperate places, one-time mining towns where no white men show their faces. We set out for Pretoria on this highway first thing next morning. Quinn and I in the back seat, Johnson up front, driving. A sea of zinc roofs reflected sunlight from the shanty towns as we headed north. At this early hour, men and women, all blacks, could be seen patiently walking the roadside on their way to downtown jobs. I turned on my laptop to brief Quinn on our presentation. In front, Johnson carefully ignored us both. An hour later, we were being passed through the first set of gates at Gerotech, a rambling military installation tucked into the rugged foothills of the Magaliesberg Mountains. The place was a military playground, a Disneyland of war games. You could see why Paul Kruger had chosen to launch the Boer War from this forbidding region, why the apartheid-era government was rumored to have hidden its nuclear bomb somewhere on these very grounds. Colonel Pym and his staff of blonde giants were waiting for us in front of the main office facility. He shook my hand, then tossed an arm over Quinn's shoulders. Quinn is the boss. Johnson, of course, might well have been a small black mongrel. I looked over my shoulder as we walked through the heavy doors and caught the man glancing after me. He quickly turned his attention back to the limo and began tinkering under its hood as we entered the main building. We gave our presentation, and then we lunched. Loud jokes, steaks, beer, Cuban cigars, business as usual. According to plan, I kept glancing at my watch and leaning toward Quinn to remind him, in a voice just loud enough for the South Africans to overhear, that we had a late afternoon conference call with the States. We shook hands with Pym and his staff at 4:30 in the afternoon and then stepped back outside. Mountain light had set the edges of things on fire. Johnson seemed not to have moved all day from his spot beside the car. As he had drove around to pick us up, I stood facing the autumnal wind. It swept uphill from the south, as if from Antarctica itself, fresh and fierce, making the chaparral and scrub trees shiver like feeling things on the stepped hills below.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Derek Green, reading from his story collection, A New World Order, by Autumn House Press. One of the other kind of linking things I noticed between the stories, and as I get the question out, Ellen, is it's both tone and theme. And one of the themes, as is in there, is this idea of commerce. You know, there's a lot of commerce, whether it's military commerce or company commerce, industrial commerce. There's even a story where it's about trying to get a souvenir, you know, kind of personal commerce. And there is a tone that I guess my question is, you're having been a journalist. It's journalistic, but it doesn't feel completely devoid of emotion, you know, that kind of a complete objectivity. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering, in terms of trying to negotiate those things, like trying not to make the commerce sound too abstract, too devoid of emotion in the tone, how did you get to that point?
Well, hopefully I did get to that point. It sounds like you think it works in some places.
I bought it. Yeah. Well,
great. That's good news. That was a trick. That was one of the trickiest parts of the book. And it's an unusual – for literary fiction, as you know, it's an unusual landscape. So it was there's sort of a literary fictive landscape that's available to all of us who write that, the sort of suburban. There's a code and you're immediately into it. And I found myself completely without that when I started writing this. Mm. It's like, geez, there's no mall to point to. So how do you signal things? So I think part of the solution to that was tone. And when I talk to students about the story, that's one of the things that they immediately they seem to imagine these big blocks of description. And then when we go back through, they see that there really are just a few little details sprinkled. So you have this pressure to do that, and that's very similar to journalism. That's sort of how in a compressed state, the compressed space you have when you're writing journal. I wrote narrative journalism. You know, I was never a hard news writer. I wrote features. And that's the trick. And it's sort of a sleight of hand, you know. If you've ever been the subject of journalism, you always feel like, that's not me. I didn't say these things. And that's part of the nature of the beast, that you're taking a detail to signal things to sort of.
Well, and there was a way that the tone, you know, you could tell that there was that kind of compression. I would even say at times that when we're in the point of view of particular characters, it's the I'm just going to think about the commerce because I don't want to think about the other stuff that's kind of pushing in on me.
Yeah, that's the other thing. And this commerce, one of the reviewers pointed that out and said that this becomes this huge ethic of moving. And it even the stories start to have this motion based on the sort of desperate need to just move goods and keep them moving, emotional or literal, which I thought was great. I wish I had known that. I wish I had thought of that while I was writing a book.
But good that it came out in the review.
If at least they saw it. So, that's part of the balance. And how do you make people with specific jobs and specific places still have feelings? And so that becomes the trick of, you know, there's this impression of the ugly American, and he does rear his head in a story or two here. But there's also really hardworking, decent
people doing their job,
and they can be torn. And you get these, and I remember being in these places. This feeling of, are we exploiting these? All the clear answers disappear once you get there on the ground. If you pay attention, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's sort of complex, and if you know, that was sort of part of what I was doing there. That's what I saw. But this whole idea of commerce, that's what Americans do in these places.
And absolutely.
It keeps you apart from it.
Well, I think it keeps you apart. And it also it gives you a way to get a foothold. Like we know the commerce. We know how to do that exchange.
Good point.
And so it gives us a chance to at least take that first step.
Americans are good at that, and it does provide you emotional distance. You don't have to – you can just be the good businessman
right.
or businesswoman and not have to actually deal with human things.
Right. Could you finish up tonight with one short piece?
Yes. Thanks. I will do that. This is from a story called Road Train, which is literally about the movement of goods across – in the case of this story, Australia. And this story I'd initially – been invited, like the unfortunate journalist in this story, to go on a road train trip with a road train driver. I didn't do it, which, as it turns out for my narrator of this story, is probably good for me. The story is called Road Train, and he does accept the invitation, and something really unfortunate happens. And as they're driving, there's the risk that they're going to have this parched Australian outback, but there's always the risk of a washout. And so they've been worried about this all along. And of course, well, so here we are in the middle of this trip. Sheets of heat lightning shivered on the far horizon. These were soon replaced by forking tongues of lightning the color of blue steel and bone. The first fat drops of rain spattered against the flat windshield. The sun disappeared behind ugly thunderheads. The stone-dry, cracked earth riverbeds began to run with water, ropey rivulets that writhed and grew and seemed alive. For a long time, neither spoke. They drove into the darkening night and through it. Water pounded down, biblical rain. The lightning continued, backdropped by a spectral night palette of crimson, violet, and jaundiced yellow.
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Derek.
Thank you, Helen. Good time.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Ben Cole, Michelle Stoner, and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, on independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.